Hey everyone. Hello. Well, I sort of know what I want to talk about tonight, but it's been really interesting. I've had the opportunity and the privilege to be able to talk with several of you over the last few weeks, and we've been kind of getting together one-on-one and talking. And as we've been going through whatever it is that each individual wanted to talk about, I noticed that there was a theme developing. And a lot of what the guys wanted to talk about was sort of the nature of church, the nature of faith, and there was a lot of resistances coming up, deep-seated resistances from the past, such as, you know, how can I trust a God that is manifested in a church? You know, because look at church. I mean, look at the history of church. Look what church has done over the years and over the ages. And look at how churches fight amongst each other. Everyone thinks they're right, and then they're, you know, putting down, excluding the other, excommunicating the other, fighting bloody wars. I mean, where is God in all of that? You know, and look at individual churches. You know, look at the people in the church. They say one thing and they do another. You know, churches are filled with hypocrites, that sort of idea. And you know, in truth, churches aren't filled with hypocrites. Churches are typically filled with sinners, typically filled with people who miss the mark, who don't do the things that they want to do, the things that they believe in. But a hypocrite is someone who actually believes the opposite of what they preach. And there's very few of those, really. But what I was finding was a lot of resistances to this notion of faith. How can I relax in my faith? How can I go into my faith in a deeper way when there are all these things that just don't jive with God? And so if you think about it, how in the world do you really go through those first three steps in a real way, in a deep way? How can you really give your will over to a higher power, to God, if all these things are kind of lined up in the way? And so these are some of the things we were talking about, and it really struck me as, you know, these are the classic questions. You know, you're not going to get any argument from me if you tell me the church has been a pretty poor witness at many times in history for God. I mean, the church has a very checkered and terrible record in many ways. And let's just stop with the Christian church here. Any church, any group, any government goes through the same sort of things. But of course, what we have to be able to do is to separate church, man, right, from God. When it comes right down to it, God doesn't have anything to do with the church until the church has everything to do with God. Right? I mean, it's got to be that way. And really, while we're doing this business of separating, let's be very clear here. What is the church anyway? Is the church, you know, this monolithic institution? Is the church the building? The church is the people. We are the church. And so if you want to take that a step further, then God isn't going to have anything to do with us until we have everything to do with God. We are the church. It's like we were just talking about just now. God's presence is everywhere. It permeates this room. I like to think of it as broadcast waves. I mean, right now in this room, the room is completely filled with radio and television and shortwave broadcasts. They're all over the place. If you could really hear them all, it would be like this complete cacophony, all this noise. But we're not tuned in, and so we're oblivious. But bring in a receiver and tune it to a given frequency, and we can pick up those waves. The Lord's Spirit is just like this. It is through us and in us and in our midst. It's up to us to tune in. It's up to us to bring church into each moment. I had a very good friend of mine who founded the organization that I've been working for that feeds children primarily in Mexico. And he founded it about 30 years ago and retired just about 4 years ago in his mid-70s or so. But people always used to come up to him and sometimes say something like, you know, it's great that you're working in Mexico, but charity begins at home. Ever heard that one before? And he'd say, that's great, you know. So what are you doing at home to feed the children? Typically, there was just a blank stare and, you know, no response whatsoever. Because really, what that line was about was a way of deflecting, a way of excusing the inaction that the person basically had. What we need to be careful that we're not doing whenever we throw up some of these resistances, some of these things about, well, you know, I don't want to belong to a church. you know, that would do X and Y, and I wouldn't want to belong to a church. Let's make sure that we're not using that as excuses not to do everything that we can do in our spiritual lives to bring God deeply in. Is the resistance that we're clinging to, is some of the resentments that we're clinging to valid, or are they excuses? And even if they are valid, when is it time to let them go? What is the last thing that we're clinging to that's keeping us from a real, authentic, deep, and intimate relationship with God? And for so many of you who are in the program, new this month, we're seeing you new the last couple of weeks. You're working through these first three steps. You're just getting started. Without that rock-solid foundation in those first three steps, without that deep relationship with God, with your higher power, however you conceive that right now, it is going to be so difficult to maintain a life of sobriety. And beyond just a life of sobriety, I'm not talking about a white-knuckled life. Oh, thank God I got through another day. But a life that moves beyond that into being able to just enjoy the day. To realize that you didn't think about whatever it is your obsession covers all day long. To know that you're making real progress. And how does all this happen? How do we let go of that last thing we're clinging to and move on? I want to tell you a story, and some of you have heard this story before, so forgive me if you've heard it, but it illustrates perfectly what we're talking about here. Gosh, it's getting to be about 20 years ago, I went skydiving. How many of you have been skydiving ever? Okay, I see a couple hands. Okay, great, great. Then you're going to relate to what I'm talking about. I went skydiving one time. I loved it. I don't know why. I just, life moved on. I never got to go back again. But I went this one time, and I didn't want to take a tandem jump. If you know what a tandem jump is when you're strapped on to the jump master. So you're physically tied together, and you're just along for the ride. And he's on your back and does all the work and pulls the chute. I wanted to be able to do a lot of it myself. So I went and signed up for what's called an accelerated free fall, or AFF. And this is where you jump out of the plane with two jump masters at either side, holding onto your leg straps, and you all go down together until you pull, and then you're on your own, and you got to fly yourself in for a landing. And so the AFF required 8 hours of training on the ground. And we walked in from the parking lot, you know, all of us coming in early in the morning at Paris Valley Skydiving Center. And we went into these single-wide mobile homes that they were using for offices, and they sat us all down in these neat rows. And they proceeded to tell us in very cheery tones, you know, look at the monitor. And a monitor came on with a lawyer in a business suit behind a desk, you know, videotaped, and telling us all the terrible things that could happen to us while we were skydiving. You know, death, dismemberment, paralysis, and all of the ways that we were going to be holding the Paris Valley Skydiving Center harmless from any liability for any of these terrible things that could happen to us. And then he said, now pay attention, someone's going to be passing out a waiver of liability, which they did. And then they brought in a video camera and they videotaped us reading the waiver of liability and taping that whole thing. Now feet are starting to shuffle and people are looking at each other. And we signed it and we recorded ourselves saying it. But it started to bring home kind of the sober reality of what we're doing if we're going to jump out of a plane at 12,500 feet. And the AFF required this 8 hours, so we went into our classroom. And I kid you not, you walk into the classroom and our instructor only had one leg. And he wasn't even trying to hide it. It wasn't like a nice prosthesis or something like that. His pant leg was cut off at mid-thigh, and he had this sort of metal shock absorber pogo stick thing going on with just a, you know, just a rubber tip on the end of it. And he must have really loved watching all us newbies walking every time with a look of shock on our face. But once he got us all sat down and quiet, the first thing he said was, I didn't lose my leg skydiving. Just want you to know that. But then he proceeded to go, and we're learning about everything that has to do with skydiving. Again, they're telling us the terrible things. You can land in water. You can land in trees. You can land in power lines. The worst thing that can possibly happen is you can get fouled in your first chute so that you can't cut it away and pull your reserve. You know, that one's hard to recover from. And so we're talking about all these things. They told us about terminal velocity at 120 miles an hour in falling leaf form. You know, the falling leaf, the cupped leaf, always falls with the cup side down. Aerodynamically, it can't fall any other way. So if you assume the spread eagle position and arch your back, no matter if you're in a tumble or anything, you'll end up righting yourself. belly down, and you can stabilize your fall. And once air pressure and gravity equalizes, that's terminal velocity. So you accelerate to about 120 miles an hour, and that's it. That's as fast as you go. Of course, that's fast enough if you hit the ground at that speed. So, you know, you have to understand the psychology of what's going on here. So 8 hours of this, they talked about the circle of awareness and everything that we are going to be doing. We're going to have a big altimeter strapped to our chest. We're going to jump at 12,500. We were going to pull at 5,000, just about a mile. And at that point, the jump masters were going to be gone, and we were going to be on our own. We had a little headset so they could talk to us if we needed to. We had to actually fly in, and you couldn't believe how maneuverable these chutes were. They're basically a wing, and you had two toggles. And you could turn that thing around just pivoting on one end of your wing. It was amazing how maneuverable they were. And that's a good thing because you had to find the windsock, see which way the wind was blowing, make your first pass upwind, turn around and make your last pass. I'm sorry, I said that wrong way. First pass downwind, last pass upwind. At the end, you flare. You bring them both down and you brake, and you're supposed to step into this nice, easy stride, you know, and then pull in your chute. So that was the plan. Now, at the end of the day, they herded us into this big barn, you know, a big barn of a room, hanging with all sorts of jumpsuits and packs and helmets and goggles. And so they start suiting us up, you know, and Peg Leg is over there helping everyone get into their chutes and everything. And the feeling of nervousness that had been with me all day had been growing for 8 hours. You know, it's kind of hard to enjoy your lunch when it's all right here. And now we're getting into the gear, and they're walking us over to the airstrip. And here comes the King Air, it was called, you know, this silver plane, prop plane. And the door was just a hole in the fuselage. Didn't even actually have a door. And it comes back empty because, of course, everyone had already jumped out of it in the previous jump. And we all start piling in. And it's just a bare, empty fuselage inside. You know, nothing. No seats, no nothing. And they crammed us in there. Because you figure each jumper had two jump masters with him or her. And then some of them had a videographer who was going to go down and film them while they're falling. So you could have three more people for each jumper. So we were just lined up sitting on the floor with the person in front of us sitting between our legs. So their pack is in your chest, and your pack is in the person behind you's chest. And here we are, just rows of helmets down this fuselage as it takes off and starts getting up to its target altitude. And you're just sitting there, and I'm watching the helmets, and I'm watching the sunshine coming and playing across the sides of the plane as it's maneuvering into position. And I'm just thinking, my gosh, what did I do? You know, am I really going to do this when it comes right down to it? I hear my name called, and I get up, and I'm walking across people's legs and everything to get to the door. And I'm standing there, and I'm holding on to the edge of the fuselage, and I'm looking down. And you know, it's just like anything you've seen from the window of a plane or in a movie. The ground doesn't even look real. It looks like some sort of painting. It looks two-dimensional. It looks flat. And I'm looking out, and my jump master's coming beside. They had told us that we were going to time our jump, you know, one, two, three, and everybody was going to go out the window at the same time or out the door at the same time. You know, it's amazing. When you really get nervous, you sort of forget things. I couldn't remember if it was on three or after three, you know. But all I remember is I pushed off, and I was all alone. Nobody was with me. And there's that feeling, that immediate feeling where even though all this wind was in my face, I couldn't breathe. I couldn't exhale. You know, just that complete hyperventilation feeling. And I realized, oh, my God, I really did it. I jumped, you know. And all that training, everything that we had gone through, now was a real thing. And whatever I did now, the sequence of events had been started that were going to end at the ground one way or another, in a nice flare or at 120 miles an hour. And all I could do was just fall at this point. There was nothing left. I remember holding on to that doorway. My fingerprints are probably still in that doorway if the King Air still exists. But I pushed off, and then I was falling. And then eventually my jump masters caught up to me. I just remember their faces kind of lowering into position, and there they are. And, you know, they start telling me what to do. We go through the circle of awareness. Everything is fine. I look at my altimeter. They said, okay, we're going to pull at 5,000. And then he just yelled in my ear, enjoy the ride. There was nothing to do until we got to altitude. And so I'm just there in my spread eagle, and I'm looking around, and you didn't even feel like you're falling anymore. When everybody's falling at the same rate together in unison, It just feels like right now, just sitting in your living room talking to these guys. They're all there, except you got 120-mile-an-hour wind in your face. But other than that, you just feel like you're just static. You don't even feel like you're falling. I thought it would be like a roller coaster, you know, that feeling of your stomach in your throat the whole time. But it was only like that the first few seconds while you're accelerating. Once you get to your final velocity, everything just seems normal. And I remember looking at the ground, and the only cue that I was actually falling was that if I looked, fixed my stare at an object on the ground, it was just slowly getting bigger. That was the only thing that told me that I was actually falling. But that was enough. That reminds you pretty quick. All of a sudden, they were screaming in my ear, and I looked down, and it's 5,000. I couldn't even, you know, believe how fast it came, and it was time to pull. And I pulled the cord, and their faces just went, and just gone. You know, it was the weirdest thing. You know, I felt like I was just yanked up by puppet strings straight up into the air, and they went on down. And I looked up, as I was trained to do, and my chute was big and orange and perfect, no problems. Reached up, found my toggles, and I think the one image that stayed with me the longest, because the free fall was this roar and this wind, and as soon as you pull, instead of falling through the air is just kind of gently pushing you along. It was completely silent. And I remember looking down at my boots and kicking my feet, and there was nothing beneath them but 5,000 feet of air. It was just the weirdest thing. But it was beautiful at the same time, and it was quiet. And I landed fine, obviously, and everything was wonderful. But as I was thinking about this whole experience, I started thinking about the fact that all during the day, when I was signing the insurance waiver, I was nervous, I was scared. When I was going through the training with Peg Leg, I was nervous and I was scared. And that ramped up all day long until I'm putting on the gear and I'm getting to the plane. And as I'm holding on to the doorway, you know, I'm feeling that fear and that terror. But here's the interesting thing to me. The moment I pushed off and I had no more choices to make, the fear left me. It was like I had my last choice. The last thing that I was clinging to was that door. But once I pushed off and I was free falling, what is there to cling to? What was there to hold on to? That sequence of events was going to end at the ground, and there was nothing that I could do about it except what I knew to do, what I had been trained to do. And I did it, and it was fine. And I remember the jump master in my ear, "Enjoy the ride. Enjoy the ride." And I did. I enjoyed it so much I almost missed the altitude for pulling the cord. It was an amazing revelation to me to think about how the choices that we have, the choices that we think we have, are sources of anxiety and worry for us. As long as we think we have a choice, we think we can have a chance to screw something up. We can make a wrong choice, or we can make a right choice, and it's not going to be what we want or what we thought it was or whatever. But the point is that having a choice that stops us, that we cling on to? And the things that we choose, we cling on to. Think about it. What are the things in your life that you're still clinging on to? Is there anything? There's a great story in Brendan Manning's book, Ruthless Trust. And he talks about John Kavanaugh, who is a famous ethicist, a writer here in the United States, who was just going through a terrible time in his life. And he decided to make a pilgrimage to Calcutta and to visit Mother Teresa and see if he could straighten out his life. And so he makes the arrangements and he flies to India. And on his first day in the house of the poor in Calcutta, he meets Mother Teresa. And she sees him there and she knows who he is. And she says, "Well, what can I do for you?" And he says, "Well, pray for me." And she says, "All right, what shall I pray for?" And he says, "Pray that I might have clarity." Clarity. And you know what she said to him? She goes, "No, I won't do that." And he was shocked. And he said, "Well, why not?" And she said, "Because clarity is the last thing that you are clinging to and must let go of." And he said, "But you always seem to have such clarity." And she laughed and said, "I don't have clarity. What I have is trust. I will pray that you have trust." You see, when we look at people who have trust from the outside, it looks like they have clarity. They have a serenity to them. They have a certain certitude to them. They make decisions and they move through their lives and they can do it with a smile and they can do it with this I don't know, just this sense of being in touch with God and with each other and with reality. And we want that. And we think it's clarity. But from the inside out, from their experience, they're going through life just as we are, making their choices as best they can with whatever information they have. And we think that it's clarity, but it's really trust. What is the last thing that you're holding on to and must let go of? What is the last thing that is standing between you and being really able to just fall into the arms of God? To be able to take those first three steps to a new level. You know, whatever it is that you're clinging on to, whether it's drugs and alcohol, whether it's relationships, toxic relationships, even good relationships, whether it's money or talent, you know, just go down the list. Whether it's resentments against church, resentments against people, resentments against the circumstances in your life, those things that you're holding on to are the very things that are keeping you from experiencing the free fall of trust. So each one of those things is like a door in the sky that you're holding on to. And here's the real irony. You think that you're holding on to a door in the sky. But really, when it comes right down to it, each one of us is already free falling. From the moment of your birth, from the moment that you were pushed out of your mother's fuselage, okay? Want to look at it that way? From that moment, you've been free falling. There has never been an instant in your life when you weren't free falling toward what? Toward the ground of your death. There is an end to this free fall. At some point, we're going to hit the ground. And the only thing that we can do is choose how. In a nice flare, or kicking and screaming in wide-eyed terror at 120 miles an hour. That's our choice. We didn't get to choose whether or not to jump. That choice was made for us. Guess what? Each one of us right now sitting in this room, we think we're static, we're free-falling. And our choice is whether or not we can enjoy the ride. How do you do that? How do you enjoy the ride? By knowing that it's going to have a soft landing at the end. How do you do that? By knowing the God who stands behind everything that we see. How do we do that? Do you know that at the end of chapter 7 in Matthew, the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talks about some people who will say, "Lord, Lord, look at all these things that I did in your name. You know, I preached, I healed the sick, I did this, I did that. You know, let me into your presence, let me into kingdom." And the Lord says, "I never knew you. I never knew you." That word to know in Aramaic, yada, or in Hebrew, yada, means to know. But you know what it really is when you go back to the roots? Yada, yada, is the ancient word for hand. And what it really means to know in Hebrew, to know in Aramaic, is the ability to be able to handle something. To know something so well in muscle memory that your hand actually remembers. Think of a carpenter, if any of you are carpenters. If you just imagine it right now, you can feel the weight and the shape of the hammer in your hand. Because of all the years and all the hours that you spent with that tool, it just fits. You know it in your hand. Talk to Rob or Joe who play guitar up here. They can feel the instrument even when it's not with them. Think of anything that you know that well, that you do that well, and you can feel the shape of it. You can feel the shape of your beloved's face in your hands because you've known that person for so long and you've been with them for so long. That's what it means to know in Hebrew. It has nothing to do with a thought in our head. It has everything to do with years and hours together to know. It's even a euphemism for intimate relations. Adam knew his wife and she conceived and bore a son. To know meant to bring someone into your tent. To know them intimately. This is what God is talking about. If you want to know God, if you want to be able to trust God, if you want to be able to enjoy this ride, you got to spend some time. And the illusion that you have a choice as to whether you can stop this process or not, is that. It's just an illusion. We're already free-falling. And so to break through whatever you're thinking is holding you back, it has nothing to do with church. It has nothing to do with any of these things. It has only to do with your own desire. Do you want to move in? And how do you do that? You do it by starting to enjoy the ride. To just let yourself go. To fall with God. I guess that's the best way to look at it. Falling with God. Allowing yourself to go there. And just trust and see what will happen if you just let go. I'm going to do a little word picture with you, I guess. Close your eyes for a second. Imagine that you're 8 or 9 years old. It's summertime, it's hot, and you're over at your neighbor's pool with a bunch of kids. You're in your swimsuit. Your skin is dark brown because you spent the whole summer out there practically in that pool with those friends. And what you do is you come and you stand by the edge of the pool and you turn around backwards and you dangle your heels off the edge so that you're just gripping the side of the pool with your toes. And you put your arms out straight out at your shoulders and you start to tilt your head back. Now, the last time you looked at the water, last time you looked behind you, that pool was filled with sparkling blue water. And all your friends are bobbing around in the pool. It's slapping against the sides. Last time you looked, that's what it was like. But if you push back and you're going to fall in, is the water still there? Is it going to catch you? Is it going to give you that wonderful slap against your back? How are you going to know? The only way you're going to know is when you press down with your toes and feel the center of your gravity moving backward until you pass that point of no return, and there you go, falling backward until the water does slap you on the back and you submerge and you push off the bottom and pop back out the top and you look around at the ring of faces of your friends all dripping and laughing. You believed that the water would catch you and break your fall. You had faith that the water would catch you and break your fall when you pushed down and fell backward. But you didn't have trust until you said, "Let's do it again." When what we do becomes so much fun, when what we do becomes a joy, when what we do is simply enjoying the ride, that's when we know we have trust. Others are going to think we have clarity, but it's trust. It's knowing that the end of the ride is going to be okay. It's knowing that someone is going to catch us when we fall back. The only way we can work towards this is to just break through and to just test the trustworthiness of God. And all of you, whatever you're going through, whatever you think might be blocking you, just let yourself go. Start free falling and see what happens. Because that's the way that we're going to know that we know that we know, in the way that the Hebrews understood that term, that God is who He says He is and that He will catch us every time we fall. Thanks for letting me share.